have a special treat. This is a person who has belonged to our Sangha and been practicing Zen for how long have you been practicing Zen? This is a fill-in-the-blank introduction.
I would say about 12 years.
12 years. This is Janine Seitetsu Larson. And I'll give you just a little background. She trained at Western Washington in Bellingham. A self-designed degree, she said, in managing nonprofits. And then she worked as a consultant, as she says, helping rich people give away their money.
That was a great job.
And when she became part of our Sangha, she actually helped us a lot with fundraising issues. She's been a member of the UU Church, Unitarian Universalist congregations, for 15 years, and for 9 years served as the district executive for the Pacific Northwest District, which includes congregations in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Alaska. And she's responsible for working with all of their congregations, those congregations. How many of them are there?
We have 60.
60 congregations, and helping them with all of the various issues that come up with that many people. She's also a member of our Sanghakai program, is a program that Hogan designed for our senior lay students. They meet for 3 years. They have to make a 3-year commitment. They're handpicked. And then they meet 4 times a year, is that right? 4 weekends a year. They have a practice commitment beyond that, but they meet 4 times a year. And they're all given assignments as to what they are going to present. And so they work their way through Theravadan Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, and then many, many other topics. And one of the talks that Seitetsu gave us was on religious polity. And it was extremely interesting. I thought, wow, that sounds so boring. But it was extremely interesting, and it was so relevant. So I convinced the program committee, since I'm one of the members of the program committee, to include her because I thought the talk was so relevant to what we're doing. We're trying to create a new organization, but you know, people have done this a lot before and created organizations in different ways. So religious polity essentially means how do you organize yourself as a religious organization, which is what we're trying to do. And then also, how do you pick and train ministers, in our case, priests? How does that happen? It happens differently in different religious organizations. And the UU model is not a bad model for us because they do essentially what we do. We say to a person, oh, you go out and start a group over there, and then the group forms around them. So it's a kind of the group authorizes the priest in a way. The Sangha picks the priest. So how do you train and pick ministers or priests? And then the question that was the last question that was raised at our last discussion, which I think is pivotal and underlies a lot of our difficulties, is what is the difference between a lay person and a priest? And we really are not directly addressing that question. And I think we have to. At the White Plum, this came up about, I don't know, 10 years ago, with people saying, do we really need ordained people? And because most of the people we serve are lay people, and lay people can be very senior practitioners and be very good teachers, which is true. But Joan Halifax, who was there, said, you know, I'm a cultural anthropologist, and I have to tell you, in all cultures, there are people who are ordained, people who take on a special function to handle the ceremonies, the passages, the sacred aspect of life. That's their profession. So I thought that was a very interesting answer, and I know Janine has her own answers about this. What's the difference between lay people and ordained people? Because in UU, they also have senior lay people who do a lot of functions.
That would be me.
Yeah. So she's going to talk about polity, also questions of authority, who has authority and how you get authority. And then she's done so much work with congregations in trouble. As you can imagine, 9 years, 60 congregations. They have issues which we haven't thought of, thank goodness.
Maybe I can teach you some.
So you can bring those questions to her too. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Well, finger puppets too.
Oh, I love finger puppets. Thank you, Hogan. Thank you. I think somebody is looking at the sound, maybe. Is Gary?
Yeah.
back there. Oh, he's right behind me. That's wonderful. Well, thank you very much for inviting me to join you. It's wonderful to be here and such a privilege. So thank you very much. I decided to make this a lot more interesting, mostly for me, and I hope it won't be over-the-top interesting for you, because I decided mere moments before I turned on the machine here to completely reorder all my slides. So that would be fun, because my paper notes are in the old order, so I might stall a little bit as I note the slide and figure out where I am. So we'll see how that goes. I see congregational polity as not having a lot of understanding or meaning until we have an understanding of power dynamics, because that is one of the reasons that polity arose, so that that could become explicit rather than just implicit. So in all of our congregations, I'll probably use that word quite a lot, because that's the language I'm used to using with my folks. But, so translate that to mean your own sanghas and your communities. Understanding power dynamics in a religious community, I think, is vital for us in order to be healthy leaders and effective leaders. If we don't have a good idea of what's going on, what people are bringing into the Sangha in terms of their own understanding of power dynamics, then we're going to be at a disadvantage, and we will be wandering in the wilderness a little bit, wondering what is going on here, why are they responding to me in this way. So looking at power dynamics, we will want to look a little bit at explicit and implicit power and authority, those things that are surfaced and known and written down, and those things that are understood and misunderstood, the implicit. I will want to talk a little bit tonight about cultural framing and what that means, what people bring to us, just out of the culture in which we live, to take a little bit of time with personal power and also with corporate power. Corporate power in this case meaning the power that exists within the organization, within the Sangha, the religious community. And some of the dynamics related to privilege and oppression, or privilege and less privileged. And finally, the information about religious polity as part of the power dynamics we'll look at as well. So when we take on the mantle of religious authority, whether that is as an ordained person or whether that is as a lay person who has been put in a role of leadership, we will have to pay attention in a different way to formation and standards for ourselves, to pay attention to understand the roles and signs of authority, and to pay attention to the differences between ordained clergy and lay leaders. And now I'm going to look for the notes that I had for this. So see, I told you this was going to be interesting. Here we go. So can you go to the next one? So that is not what I thought it was going to be. We'll just go with this, and everything will come out. Rollo May posited four types of personal power here. Self-affirmation, that is confidence in one's own worthiness, dignity, and respect, self-respect, enlightened self-interest, self-assertion, setting firm boundaries for self with others. Aggression is a type of personal power, that is intrusion into someone's space and rearranging their resources. And violence, the irrational lashing out when there's no sense of options. Bruce Reed also developed a workshop for the Alban Institute on personal power, and in that workshop he taught about instrumental power, that is having stuff that extends our power and status, the power of projection, how people see us. That is, people want to believe that a minister, a priest, can cure someone who is ill, as with a laying on of hands. So there's the power of projection there. The more people believe in positive, the more they perceive your effectiveness, the more they will project onto you. The power of position, how we will use and misuse elected and appointed roles. That is, clergy might get concerned when a bishop is appointed. Lay people might get concerned when a new priest comes. And the interesting aspect of altruism. We have not always felt comfortable with self-interest, and have projected instead a need for altruism. But we can see it also as egocentrism, as a form of dualism, and altruism as a sense of no separation. Corporate power isn't as transportable as personal power is. It doesn't necessarily transfer to a new group or a new congregation, a new organization. We see in corporate power the currency of power. Others having the ability to influence the corporate system for good or for ill. And we see types of power that are both implicit and explicit. Implicit sources of power include the reputational power based on the experience of someone or with someone, their perceived high status as with professionals. We see in reputational power those with the ability to develop trusted and caring relationships. And these folks are accorded reputational power, those who throw temper tantrums and exhibit disruptive behavior are also accorded this kind of reputational power. People coddle them and give in to them to prevent those eruptions so they can accrue a great deal of power in your community. Some of you are smiling, and I bet you've experienced that. The longer someone is in a particular role, the more reputational power they accumulate, and it makes them harder to remove them from that role. So they have accrued just enormous reputational power, and that's one of the reasons that so many religious organizations will put in place recommendations or requirements that people remain in positions only for a short period of time, to see all roles as temporary so that there can also be some limits on that reputational power that is accrued. Coalitional power is another source of implicit power where it is not formalized but does exist. These are like-minded groups who can come together and through talking with one another, through gaining power with one another, they speak with one voice to influence and maneuver systems. So coalitional power can be formal or informal. You will often see it in factions, whether they are divided or unified. You will see coalitional power forming often and splitting off, coming together, forming unions maybe. Factions will tend to caucus over specific events and coalesce around those events to gain power. People who act, they come to learn that people who act individually are like political dust, that coalitions can sweep them away. So that's one of the reasons that coalitions form implicitly, is that they're able to accrue greater power. People of color must be in touch with their self-interest in order to accrue power because we, in a dominant paradigm, we have often diminished the power and of people of color and accorded them a position that is less privileged. So it is important to recognize the importance of self-interest, not just an altruistic state, in order to build the coalitions you need to have both implicit and explicit power if you have been in a position of a less powerful group out of the dominant paradigm. So for people of color, their experience of systemic racism and oppression requires a certain level of self-advocacy that the privileged take for granted, and because people who are privileged are able to choose from many options, and that's not always the case for those who have been less privileged. When options diminish for those who have been in places of less power, the sense of empowerment also diminishes. They may experience loss of hope or apathy, withdrawal, and those who feel they have no power for whatever reasons often feel like they have no ability to influence a system, and they can experience the world as hostile and barren, and they can respond to it, therefore, with desperation and violence. So power dynamics have powerful forces within the individual and as the individual comes into a group. People of privilege might not even notice a tendency to marginalize and disempower those who maybe are older or younger, those who have young children, those who are of a minority culture or are less educated, non-drivers, people who are poor, unemployed in lower paying jobs, unable to take time off, not powerful English speakers, very short, overweight, poorly groomed, homeless, and similarly outside circles of privilege. So these power positions are always at play in our congregations and our religious communities, and ones to pay attention to. They have a great deal of implicit power or lack of, and it's up to us as leaders of our communities to pay attention to those and decide what we will do about that. So I would encourage you to take a look at the currencies of power. You know what this is? I just want to check and see what this slide is, because this is not what I was expecting. Yeah, this is the wrong slideshow. So let's, no wonder I'm getting confused. Let's, the other one looks almost exactly like that. Go ahead and close that one and open this one. There, now go to the slideshow here. Yeah, it's pretty good, huh? They're similar. I just changed some of the language, so that was the only reason I noticed here. So now we'll just zoom to that same slide, which was about power analysis. So there we go. So this is less having to do with my own sangha here, but some questions that you can ask yourself with your leaders, your lay leaders, your ordained people. And you're preparing to be ordained people, to be aware, what are the currencies of power in your sangha, in your center, or in your temple? And who are the holders of the explicit role power? Who are the individuals and subgroups that have impactful and implicit influence? Savvy leaders can increase their effectiveness in times of change and controversy by understanding how outcomes are likely to be influenced by currencies of power. So this works as a routine power analysis model. So one definition of authority is role power. Explicit roles can carry just enough authority to carry out specific functions within the organization. And we find that those with poor differentiation may assume their power is personal and not role-related. So we will often see that playing out in a congregation or a religious community.
Can you just have a few more sentences about that? Because that's very important.
Yeah, sure. Often when this I think is at play as you're looking at lay leaders who come into positions of leadership in the temple and begin to confuse the fact that they have some explicit authority granted to them in this very limited role, they begin to not differentiate themselves from that role, from the granted authority, and can then start to see themselves as having authority and power and leadership in areas where they are, in fact, not granted that authority. So that's where we can often come into some places where we're, you know, hitting our heads against walls or not understanding why this is not going well when people have confused their own self with the role that they were asked to step into. So this is not only a problem, of course, with lay people, but also with priests in training, with those who have not yet been granted by their community and by their teachers, authorities to teach. So it's that role differentiation is very important. So often people have confusion about their roles because it lies in that implicit quarter, that implicit area that they are making assumptions about one thing, you are assuming another thing. So the more clearly roles are defined, obviously, the less confusion there is going to be about authority issues. When an individual comes into a position of leadership, they look at different structures, different grantings of authority, of implicit and explicit power, to understand how to access formal and informal communication systems. They look for structural power when they are explicitly granted a role within an organization. They may be undermined if implicit leaders who have not been given roles of authority don't cede power when they're supposed to be ceding power. And so we just need to understand the interplay between individuals and the roles they occupy and the relationship between the congregation and the roles that are necessary to make a system function well. So I wanted to talk a little bit, too, about congregational polity. So polity is simply just the structure of governance or ministerial authority that we see in a religious community. It arose to help make explicit the power dynamics in a congregation, in a spiritual or religious community. And what I have seen is that an understanding explicitly about the polity that is at play within a religious community very much helps people to understand what it is they're coming into. We all bring our own stories and our own baggage, our own histories, and our own curiosities about what the polity is in a new organization, particularly a religious organization, where we may have come out of a system with a particular kind of polity, and that's what we understand. And here we are in this brand new system, and we're trying to figure out, how does this work? How does this work? How to make sense of this? I have also seen that people who have had no religious background will still bring baggage in, because what they're getting is an idea of religious polity that comes from popular culture, that comes from movies or books, or what they might understand about how religions work, and they will cast that onto your community if you're not clear in your own mind and if the community is not clear about what the polity is. So these are three common types of polity in the United States and in Western religion that I have found that most people in our congregations tend to understand one of these better than others. And then when they come into a Buddhist community, now they can be really confused because they have not in this country, by and large, run into much lineage authority. And they may not be familiar with the kind of congregational polity that is at work here too. So let's look at these three to see which kinds of, to learn a little bit about these congregational polity understandings that people might be bringing. So a primary kind, and I think this episcopal polity is one of the most common for people who have never been involved with a religious organization may come in with this idea of polity, because this is, examples are the Catholic Church, for example, and it's very, very prominent in our cultural background, the culture that we see, where people will pull things from art, from literature, from song. And this polity, which is practiced by some of these religions, Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Anglican, and some of the African American Pentecostal traditions also operate within this polity. Episcopal polity is very top-down. So the archbishop or the pope will have the primary power. They are standing in the place of God, and they hold God's power on earth. And from that power, the bishops are next in line. They are beholden to the power of the archbishop. The bishops will oversee maybe dioceses. And this is an example. I'm giving you some generalities here. Every religion will have some differences, but this type of polity, the top down, is just, in general, follows this pattern. Within each diocese, there are a number of clergy, and the clergy people, the priests here in this case, oversee even the lay councils that are pulled together to help govern the congregations or to help work with the congregations. So each of these structures is more powerful than the one before, and it's the role of the further on down layers to carry the traditions, the rules, and the authority of the person above them. So top-down power is the example here.
So think of Soto Shu as you're looking at these, and the polity we've inherited from Japan, and then how we're changing it here. But just keep that in mind as you're looking at
yeah. Right, so, and I didn't mean to say that was the polity there, but it is interesting to look at what polity have you inherited, and how crazy will that be for people who really don't know that polity. They're just barely understanding American polities, and so now they're coming into something that's clearly out of their experience.
It's kind of traditional business model.
Kind of, yeah. And military, too, yeah. I mean, a lot of these polities have a lot to do from either leading the business world or coming from military models. So it's very interesting. They all tie together in that way. So this next type of polity, Presbyterian polity, you will see it feels like it's somewhat the same thing with authority kind of being in a hierarchy. But this one tends to come kind of bottom up. So the Presbyterian Church obviously is an example of this, the Reformed, and actually the United States Episcopal Church uses this model too, whereas the Anglicans are more in the other model. But in this one, a congregation will have a board of lay people, the session. It may be called in a Presbyterian polity, that is led and held in authority by a clergy person. The clergy people will get together and elect people to a larger presbytery or assembly, a synod. And so each of these layers operates independently to a point, but the layer ahead of them, the layer in front of them, they elect people to, and that's kind of like their court of appeals. So if you can operate just fine as a session or in your clergy groups or within the presbytery, but if the synod decides to reverse that rule, then they have the power to do that. So it's an interesting form of bottom-up authority that kind of concentrates the power as you go up the hierarchy. So then we get to this crazy one, congregational polity, which examples are the Baptist Church. This is sometimes called Baptist polity, as a matter of fact. United Church of Christ, Unitarian Universalists. Synagogues and mosques, by and large, are based on congregational polity, too. Even if there's a larger body to that kind of oversees them or hands down teachings or rules or interpretations, these organizations and our Buddhist practice groups, sanghas, temples, practice centers are also based very much on congregational polity. They are owned at the congregational level. Many of these are owned, in fact, by the congregation itself. The lay people who make up the congregation are the ultimate authority in many examples of congregational polity, in most examples. For example, in Unitarian Universalism, the congregation is the constant. The congregation will call the minister. While the minister does have independence and authority in their own right, they can also be dismissed by the congregation. They do not own the congregation. And the congregation has the right to overturn, by getting rid of the minister, any rules or ideas that the clergy person brings to them. So there may be associational bodies that the congregation and the clergy correspond with and work with, districts, regions, a large association. Many of these groups in congregational polity will come together to make ground decisions, foundational decisions, in a general assembly, a national kind of gathering where people are elected to go and vote on different stances or platforms. But it can come back to varying degrees to the congregation. So Buddhism does have, in America, does have some relationship to this one, as well as the lineage polity, right? So lineage polity is one that I haven't outlined here because I don't think there are a lot of that polity in the United States other than in Buddhism. There are some non-denominational churches. Chosen mentioned the Crystal Cathedral, where there's kind of a familial lineage in that case, but not so common in the United States. Most people belong to one of these three polities. So as I was saying, if people come into your spiritual community without grounding in one of these primary polities, chances are they have come from no religion at all, and or from outside our dominant culture here. But these power structures, too, they will, people who have no experience with religious community will very likely come into your community and overlay an understanding that they have grabbed from somewhere about how your organization should work, how the temple should work, how the sangha is run and operates. They may pull something from governance, from political governance, elected governance. They may assume that you operate on a general nonprofit organizational structure where you've got an elected board and the board holds the power for the organization, or the membership votes on everything. So they may come in with that idea. They may also have an experience of a collective and really feel that everybody owns this, everyone is equal, and all the decisions are made by that. So it can be confounding for someone to come into an organization where the priest really does get to say, and has a great deal of influence, if not power. in the organization, in the congregation. Other sources of power structures that are familiar to people who come without an existing understanding of how religious community works is just a model of authority that they see, for example, in a family background, parental authority, school authority, what they find at work, laws and the legal system, and relational authority. That is one of the reasons that we see sometimes inappropriate relationships forming is that it can be sometimes about power, to gain power based on who you are allied with or how well known you are, gathering the reputational power of someone else or the actual power of someone else. So these are quite common. So as we look at Buddhist polity, I just wonder, what are the sources of authority in Buddhist polity? How do you see Buddhism now and as you imagine it, moving into a different relationship with autonomy and accountability, other than just the strict congregational polity that you've had and the lineage polity with the authority and the homage that you owe to your teachers? How is this changing, and what's the role of influence in relationship in Buddhist communities today? How are individuals in relationship with one another in our communities? And how do these power and authority structures relate to individuals in the community? Do you have explicit structures for them? Are they very implicit, not told, must be divined? Or do you have you developed now some structures for your folks? So this is some of the stuff that you've been discussing today, I think, right, and are discussing this week. And this is changing, I think. So this is one of the reasons that you're looking at how to make relationships work. So one of the reasons that this makes a difference is that it will influence how you set up formation and standards for both ordained clergy and for your lay leaders. So let me grab my notes here, make sure I've got them, because this is the part where it gets kind of interesting, I think. Sorry about that. So what I have seen is, as we look at lay leaders in this culture, it is natural for lay leaders to expect to come into the religious life of the community and to help with leadership. But we haven't necessarily had great models to do that. We experience this too in Unitarian Universalism, where we have the clergy and then we have the lay people with no way of really recognizing lay authority. We don't have a diaconate, for example, where we don't have deacons. We don't have structures in Unitarian Universalism to recognize lay leaders that have been given religious authority. And so there is a constant impression where that if you want to deepen your spiritual practice, if you want to deepen your service to the community, if you want to be able to offer religious leadership gifts, you must become ordained. And that's not necessarily the right path for every person. So what are better ways for lay leaders to be able to serve and to be recognized for their service and to be given those role clarifications and role authorities in order to serve? Often we will see that lay leaders will not understand, and I can speak to this as a lay leader, will not understand why they are not exactly the same as ordained people. Why can't they have the same roles, the same power? So how I see this is that ordained clergy, the primary difference is that ordained clergy take on religious life as primary in their lives. They devote themselves to significant education and training, to sacrificial dedication to service as a vocation, as a calling. They may have outside employment and they may have families, but still, their religious life remains primary. It has a primacy that is not the case with lay leaders. Certain rights and roles are reserved to the clergy in recognition of those standards and the depth of education, of understanding, training, and spiritual maturity, ethical modeling, and that quality of presence. So lay leaders often also have that, that quality and depth of devotional practice and ethical modeling, presence, and spiritual maturity that may be somewhat equal, but the important difference here is that they have not chosen to make the religious life primary to other relationships. And that's a significant difference, I think. It's a level of sacrifice, and it's a level of dedication that is different between lay and ordained. So with lay leaders, I think that it is always true that you will see one or more elements of either experience, proficiency, or practical commitment that doesn't rise to the standards that we require and expect of our ordained clergy. When we look to elevating lay people and ordaining clergy, we want to ensure that there are certain levels of knowledge and wisdom that they bring to this, to their service. We have, you've been talking about standards, and it is true that our seminaries, too, will prepare ordained leaders in four kind of signature pedagogies. There's a pedagogy of interpretation, critical thinking, to engage sacred texts and stories with historical and linguistic skill that shapes human meaning in a specific religious context. There are pedagogies of formation, that is the practices of ritual and various spiritual practice, the sense of the holy, religious and pastoral identity. Pedagogies of contextualization, the cultural influence in religious and clergy practice, with a necessity for a deep understanding of context, cultural context, organizational context, and the creative encounters with them, and the practices of transformation that can not only change the individual, but can also change the culture and the context. And then finally, pedagogies of performance to the development and rehearsal and expertise in complex pastoral skills and judgment.
Could you give an example of contextualization, like a practical example?
Yeah, you know, I think that understanding what's going on in the political world, for example, what's going on with justice work, where there is injustice in your community. Engaged Buddhism, I think, is an example of contextual education and pedagogy to have a deeper understanding of how things came to this point and where you might take them. So how things came to this point is understanding of the context as it has been historically and what have been the creative encounters with them, what might be future creative encounters in order to transform the individual or, in fact, the culture. That's I think, a good example of that. We also expect in both in seminary and in roles that include training for our lay leaders. We expect not only the education in these types of pedagogies, but also to demonstrate and to teach areas such as these, areas of ethics, of sexual health, and emotional intelligence, or EQ, and that that ability to bring presence that may be something that can't be taught, but it is something that can be evocative as a person deepens in their spiritual understanding and their spiritual depth. That sense of presence can come about. So this development of knowledge and wisdom, as it's taught in seminaries, also exists in the need to do training for our priests and our lay people, but at different levels. So as you're looking at your own standards, I think these are some of the things that you'll want to also see reflected in your practices and in your standardization across the various congregations that you'll see in your polity, those independent ones that also are bound together in covenant and in trust with one another in accountability. Sure. Yeah, so for example, a minister may go to seminary, or a minister may do an internship with CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education. Priests will come into training for a period of residency, for example. With lay people that are not expected to be devoting their entire lives to this, then you may modify the structures such as ZCO has done with the Sangakai program, for example. So you have developed a kind of a mini seminary or a training that's suitable for lay people to deepen their practice and to develop their leadership skills in line with the ethics and standards of this Zen community. So those are quite different levels. You have found ways to recognize lay people in different levels of experience and skill, but they're parallel to and not the same as the levels that you have recognized more formally with lineage training and with the training for ordination. These are some of the clergy roles that are specific to clergy and not necessarily the province of lay people. Lay leaders can assist with some of these and can go to a certain point with some of these. Yes?
Are you talking about in the Unitarian?
Okay, well, now that's a good question. And what I think is that... I'm sorry? Oh, I'm sorry. She asked, so am I speaking of a difference between clergy roles and lay roles here in the Unitarian Universalist Church or in Buddhism? And what I would say is that I think this is kind of general. And I think that this is one of the questions that you're probably grappling with and considering right now is where is the appropriate line, or is there even an appropriate line between lay leadership and ordained leadership, and how these different roles work. So what I have seen is that this is a place where implicit and explicit power and authority and your choice in polity really makes a difference in understanding what are appropriate lay roles and what are appropriate clergy roles. And the friction that we often see between those two roles and the lack of clarity about who does what is often because we have not made it clear and we feel fuzzy about it ourselves. So bringing these things into the the explicit realm instead of the implicit realm will help your lay people quite a bit to understand their roles as leaders, and will also clarify what are the appropriate clergy or priest roles. This is always interesting because there are always big differences in opinion. Even within Unitarian Universalism, we have community ministers who sometimes are ordained and sometimes are lay people, and they all call themselves ministers, and why are they not identical? So there are differences in training, and there are differences in what we expect of these people, and often these are the roles that I would see are the province of ordained clergy, and to a lesser extent also expressed in appropriate ways by lay people.
Can you go through each one?
Sure. Yeah, so teaching, obviously, in Buddhism there is a very long time tradition about authorization to teach and the various levels of teaching. Yet for lay people, particularly as you're looking at maintaining practice centers that are small and don't have ordained priests to serve them, and particularly regularly, so what do? You have to have lay people who are comfortable enough to share teaching at some level. So how do you help them find the appropriate level and develop the skill for that? What's your responsibility there? And how do you look at when there's a time that there needs to be intervention because someone's not quite ready to do the teaching? So that's an interesting one. Preaching in Buddhism, giving Dharma talks and speaking inspirationally in a formal setting. There's a difference between, probably a difference between what a layperson ought to present and how the layperson presents and how the ordained and transmitted priest presents.
I should mention that Janine has, or Seitetsu has, personal experience with this. She leads a sangha within her Unitarian Universalist Church. So as a layperson, she's leading a sangha. So she's looking at these issues herself, not just
Yeah, and this has been an interesting one for me because it's not just theoretical, it is practical because I want to support my own little group. I don't yet have the skills for it, so I'm very, very grateful for this Sanghakai program to help give me some of the education that I need and also to pay more attention to my role, what I can realistically and ethically do, what I ought not to do, when I call for backup, you know, when I do need someone else to help the group to the next level. So prophecy is one that you might be kind of scratching your head over, but that is religious vision, I think. The ability to see how the world might be and what is coming. It's the inspirational side of our teaching, I think, the vision beyond the here and the larger vision that we understand. It is awakening and the expression of awakening. Pastoral care is often something that lay people are very good at doing, particularly when you can't be there. But to train the lay leaders to understand what kind of pastoral care they can offer, what kind you can offer, and to know yourself, what are your limitations with pastoral care? When do you need to kick it off to somebody who's got more expertise in a particular area, counseling or medical care, for example, than you can offer? So that's another area where self-differentiation is so important, to understand that you are not all that, and certainly your lay leaders are not as well. Priestly rites, I think, are an area where lay people really want this. I see this a lot in our folks who are preparing for the ministry or lay people who fancy themselves to be ministers. This is the goodies, right? This is the good stuff. This is what they love because, again, without good self-differentiation, you kind of see yourself as the incarnate spirit, right? So the priestly rites are things that I think behoove you to have very clear boundaries around and very clear guidelines. What are appropriate roles for lay leaders, for example? They are not giving the precepts, but they can assist if it's a lay group that they help with, you know, that they lead when you're not there. So perhaps there can be roles of assistance here without expecting that lay people really ought to be taking on these roles that come with experience and authorization. I have included in here lay formation, that is to have it be one of the priest's duties to teach lay people how to function as leaders in your community. In the United States, this is just expected. We expect to be able to help lead, and it's a blessing in order to be able to do that. So to not have roles for lay leaders in some of these areas will diminish your sangha, I think.
One of the things that we've done in this particular point, we've tried to differentiate between refuge ceremonies, which the priests and ordained people do, and ethical living ceremonies, which any of our lay leaders can do. We've tried to separate that.
Yeah.
Well, being able to give, you know, the five precepts, which I reformulated this a little different way, from taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Because in most of our ceremonies, the primary refuge we take is Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And that's unfolded with the three pure precepts, the 10 great precepts. But if we just take out five pure precepts, or the first five of the great precepts, those are a benefit to everybody. So we figured out a way of having those be able to be offered in lots of different ways by non-priests. So we can still honor our priests who have devoted so many years of practice and training by they hold all the refuge ceremonies. Anyhow, it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, but this is an example. That's right. This is an example of recognizing that lay leaders have much to give if you can be creative and adaptive in how the Sangha operates, in what how you're going to define your particular polity. And I think you all have a real opportunity as you look at your standards to also think about lay formation and how they can help with the structure, support, and strengthening of the growth of Buddhism in this country, in the West, and where those lines are between priest and layperson. Because I maintain there is a difference, and there ought to be. The training that you have and that you put into it, the devotion of your life, is just different than I have. Regardless of what my skill level may be, it's just different. So I think that that's an important thing to uphold and to talk about, and it's not an easy conversation to have. That's what I've seen. Here's another area of wonderful conversation with your lay leaders as they are assuming positions of leadership and looking for ways of recognition. You know, we have titles and honorifics that we give our religious leaders, whether they're lay people or not. You know, you heard me use the word deacon, which is typically a lay leader role. So what are some of the words that you might use or the titles that you might give to your lay leaders? I mean, you've had some here, right?
Mm-hmm. Dharma holder.
Dharma holder. Mm-hmm. So there are ways that you can be creative with these, but still recognizing that there is a difference between lay leadership and ordination. Attire or regalia. Here at ZCO, you've developed a system of roksus of different colors and different, the wagesa, I think, is another one that helps people, I think, in the West to enjoy the feeling of being recognized for Yeah, and to be stylish, of course. Other signs are physical positioning, where people are sitting in the zendo, for example, or if they are have a special mat. Representing the community in public or with peers, leading rituals and rites, we talked about a little bit. In this country, there are also legal and tax provisions that are different for ordained people than lay leaders. So that's a very interesting sign of religious authority and liability. Lay leaders don't have the same kind of liability for the religious community that you do as ordained professionals. You know, you're required reporters, I would assume, in most of your states, and you have legal responsibility for your community in a way that your lay people don't, other than service on the board, and I think that's coming up here. In lay leader roles, traditionally in this country, lay leaders have mostly been involved with these roles in their communities. First of all, the role of governance, serving on boards. And that's an interesting thing, I think, with lineage polity, because who has the authority there? Who owns that community? Is it the board? Is it the congregation, the community that elects the board? Or is it the teacher? And how does that work? Have any of you had any of struggles with your boards in governance? Oh, I see some smiles. Yeah, occasionally that comes up. You are not alone in that. It's always very interesting, regardless of what your polity is. Lay people usually play roles in financial and property stewardship. Often that's appropriate in traditions where the clergy were expected not to have anything to do with this, right? So that was truly the province of lay people. Administration and management often left to lay people. This is interesting. Small group ministry is practiced in congregations large and small to provide covenant groups or small circles, Dharma circles, for lay people to have a tight relationship, to teach, to have fellowship, to teach in the sense of peer teaching and discussion, to have fellowship, to do care for one another. So that is often in the realm of lay leadership. Parish care, differentiated from pastoral care by looking at what does the community do to care for itself. This is often things like paying attention to when people need casseroles, for example. You know, they're laid up and they need some care in the home. They need help maintaining their house. So these roles are parish care roles that are often the realm of the lay people. Lay people can become elders in the church. That's another nice little word that is common in Christian circles. Even teaching elders, sometimes priests or ministers are ordained and are called teaching elders, but that can be a role for lay people who have achieved that level and yet aren't ordained. So another area where you could develop all kinds of supportive structures and helpful structures to make explicit where the boundaries are. And finally, supportive priestly rites of finding ways that your lay leaders can appropriately serve for those wonderful rituals that lay leaders would love to be involved with, but maybe aren't quite right for you. There can be ways that they can assist with those and be involved appropriately. So these are some of the lay leadership roles that I've seen here at the Zen community of Oregon. I've been quite impressed and have learned for our people too, for Unitarian Universalist congregations. This is kind of a neat little some of the positions of actually using lay people in training positions. I'm sure you all do that, recognizing community Zen leaders folks who go through the Sangakkai program and who achieve a level of, or demonstrate a level of real proficiency, may be given this title of community Zen leader, and even more so when they are truly gifted, they may be named Dharma holders here. So these are some of the things I've seen here that I've found quite inspirational. Yeah, for these things. Disciple, Shuke. Yes.
Where exactly, in our case now, we consider a disciple a lay ordained person, not yet a priest, but fall somewhere in this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So where do you draw the line and say, below this, 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 this,
this? Yeah, so that's a. Yeah, so he's asking the question, where do you draw these lines when you have recognized levels of lay leadership and also levels of ordained priests and in training? Where do you draw those lines? And I think that's the question before you in part at this gathering, is to look at how much of that must stay strictly defined at the congregational level through congregational polity in your own communities, and how much of that do you want to have conversation about maybe some new structures that you all begin to recognize as an association of Soto Zen practitioners. So that's an interesting question. And I don't know that at this point there's definition on a large scale, although you've been talking today and this time mostly about ordained levels, right? Yeah, to give some structure to that. What, you're not going to take on the lay levels this time, maybe? Yes?
That's a little more detail to Hogan's point about giving the five precepts. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And I talked to Oprah Muroshi about it, who's another teacher, and he said the problem with that is if you allow anybody other than a brown robe to give jukai, to give the precepts, it takes away from the meaning of transmission.
Sure.
That was his opinion. So it's kind of a sticky wicket.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Did you hear this? He said that that ultimately, if you give the permission to give jukai to someone who has not yet had the brown robes, it diminishes the meaning of transmission. So this is an interesting question for you.
I'm having some trouble with this discussion because it seems to me that embedded in this discussion is an implicit definition of power, which you define at the beginning.
That's right.
And there are no representatives of the community.
That's right.
Here, so I'm really uncomfortable talking about this.
Yeah, I can see that. He says that he's quite uncomfortable having this conversation, especially since we already talked about explicit power and implicit power, when there is not the lay community represented here. There are just you here. Yeah, I am. There are a few lay people here, I think, besides me, right? But so this, yeah, right. So this is exactly, I'm glad you're uncomfortable with it. And it says something about your own polity and your understanding of implicit and explicit power, because it is maybe or maybe not up to only you as the ordained leadership to make these decisions. It may be or maybe not also a role for your communities.
Some years ago, before I had received Dharma transmission, my teacher let me participate in Jukai with someone who identified as my student.
Hold it right up to your mouth. It's not on.
Is it on?
She's saying such good things, I want to make sure that we hear her. There we go. That would help.
Some years ago, before I had Dharma transmission, there was a case, the first in my experience, where there was someone who identified with me as their teacher, and wanted to take the precepts, but I was not yet authorized to do that. But my honshi over there gave me permission to study precepts with him and to help choose a name for him and participate in that way without giving me authority to give the precepts. He still gave me a feeling of inclusion with this student. And I don't know, maybe it was Jisha for the actual ceremony or something, I can't remember what I did. But he did find a way to include me without giving me the authority to do the Jukai before it was ready.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to say that I really appreciate what you're telling us, because I can identify with everything you said, and that makes me feel, it expands my feeling, it makes me feel comfortable with this uncomfortable talk. So, I appreciate what Alan says, that the other side isn't here, if we want to call it that, but we have to have this conversation regardless. And this is our side trying to figure out what we're doing with all this. And we have all the problems that you've talked about. And we somewhat dealt with them and are dealing with them, but it brings up new ways of thinking about it, mm-hmm. or reminds me of what it is that we're doing. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate that.
This says to me, really, that you, I guess I don't need this because I've already got the mic. This says to me, really, that you are not operating in strictly a lineage polity or an ecclesial polity. You really are in some form of congregational polity where you feel like you do need to not just make decisions for your communities, but to include your lay people in having these discussions and coming up with these solutions, too. That may not be the case for all of you. You know, there may be some who really do believe that the priest has been brought into the roles that you are in and given transmission, and you are the rightful ones and the wise ones to make these decisions. I certainly wouldn't want you to cede all of that to your lay people and not be involved with it at all. So there's probably some variance in the room, but it does say to me that your polity is shifting and probably isn't clear to you. Did you want to say something, Hogan?
I think that it's very important that we clarify lay leadership as part of clarifying ordained leadership, because you can't clarify one without the other. So in clarifying lay leadership, however we do that in our particular community, especially in our community where in order to be a priest takes so many years, we have to make sure that we are honoring and acknowledging and supporting them, making that whole educational track really worthwhile, while at the same time supporting people like Seitetsu. And so I think that clarifying one helps the other and vice versa.
Thank you.
There's one other point that I think we need a best practice on. It's come up in our community, and I've heard several others, that whether priests should be on the board of directors, uh-huh. if they should, if they are, in what capacity. Some places, I understand, do not allow priests to be on the board of directors. And frankly, that's where we've had our most of our problems, when a priest mm-hmm. on the board of directors got the same kind of identity confusion mm-hmm. that you mentioned before. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Fraught with peril, I would say. I think I've just got like maybe one or two more slides here, and they're wrapping up slides, I think. Oh, it was you. Hang on to that, okay? So, yeah, so these are my two kind of concluding slides. I think there are two. So, is there a need for greater clarity regarding the standards of authority? For advanced lay leaders and for ordained priests, is there a need for that, and that's what I am hearing here, is that you do, you don't have that in explicit realms yet. And how well, here's another question for you, how well are religious leaders supported by and accountable to their true peers and held in right relationship with the larger Sangha? So by true peers, I mean lay leaders held accountable by other lay leaders, priests held accountable by other priests, roshis by other roshis. How do you see that? Are you accountable only to your lineage, or are you now identifying that you're accountable to one another in a new way, or to some body that is yet to be created? And there might be one more. Oh, look, it's the lotus. So please.
Oh, actually, my question speaks to what you've just said, because at the Milwaukee Zen Center, we've been going through a very interesting transition. When I stepped down, my own teacher was interested in having me appoint a successor, i.e. lineage, mm-hmm. whatnot. And I explained that there really was no one in our lineage. It's a tiny, tiny lineage. And so I was looking, hoping for affinity. In other words, mm-hmm. a style of teaching, an approach that was useful. But that, of course, the board would have a place in this. And his response was, it made him horribly uncomfortable. Every time here in America, he heard about boards, quote, hiring
yeah.
priests. So, and at the present time, what happened was a negotiation in which the board has indeed hired my successor, but they went through then a considerable negotiation about the areas of her authority so that she was secure within those areas. So my question goes back to you, when your first, the diagram that included, I know, the Unitarian Universalists, the, you know, where the congregation, if
yeah.
you will.
The messy polity.
Yeah, the messy polity. The congregation locates and hires and makes a call to a minister. And then they can also sort of get rid of them. But what is the level of authority of that minister while they are seated? In other words,
yeah.
I'm called, I go to your place, then is there any definition about how much authority I have during the time I'm still there?
Yeah, I would say yes and no. James Ford would probably back me up on this. Thank you. I would suggest that in these cases where congregational polity has allowed the lay leaders, the congregation, to call the minister. In the Unitarian Universalist Association, we then enter into a written agreement and covenant with the minister that very clearly does lay out, you have freedom of the pulpit, you know, you oversee staff, you are to be treated this way. You know, it has covenantal and right relationship aspects to it as well. Not to say that that solves everything, right? But the intent there is to try to make those, to bring those into the explicit realm. And I always encourage our congregations to haul out those documents once a year, particularly when you've had changes on the board, and review them, because if they existed in the explicit realm at one point, they're not going to after you've had several new people come onto the board and it's years down the line and you're maybe operating a little bit differently. So that ability to make this explicit is very interesting. And I wonder if, I'd just be curious to know if those of you who are serving communities now, do you have any kind of documents like that now? Yes? Some do, yes?
So
yes?
How many people have documents in their sanghas related to what explicit documents about what the authority is of the priest, what the realm of functioning is of the priest?
Yeah. Just in the bylaws? There's no other guiding document, just bylaws? But, I mean, bylaws are something. And how many do not? How many have nothing? All implicit. So quite a few.
Have something more than just in the bylaws? Have something that's more explicit?
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends. You have motions of the board of directors sometimes that affect those things. And so how do those motions?
So...
We have a question over here.
So we're going to end this evening just a few minutes. We have time for one or so more questions. Seitetsu is an endless font of information inside the wisdom. And you can open up any single one of these doors, and she could be here all night long.
That's
right. So I think there's a couple of pivotal questions relative to what she presented, and then we'll end on time this evening at 9 o'clock.
Well, I'm not sure how to formulate this as a question. I'll just make a comment. And
that's fine.
Thanks for a great talk. The thing that came up for me was when you were sort of characterizing in a way like an ideal model that we were inheriting from Asia of this very hierarchical, top-down lineage Zen master, and how that's
ideal,
kind of
right?
It's kind of true, and then of course not true, you know. And it's exactly that misunderstanding that I think led to a lot of first generation and ongoing problems. So this discussion and what we're doing this weekend of having these, what's explicit, what's been treated as implicit, and almost, I mean, I'm just very aware of that and have experienced it, I'm sure most of us have. And this kind of weird discomfort about making explicit this tradition that's so invested in being oblique and implicit. Yeah. So, and these misunderstandings from completely different paradigms in Asia coming here, I just am fascinated by it, and I'm really grateful for your talk.
Sure. Well, one other thing that I'll mention that I forgot to talk about earlier, you know, one of the big places of transition for training priests is not only to help them understand where they're explicit and implicit roles are going to be once they're in senior positions as teachers, but also the transition from layperson to ordained person, or even from layperson to lay leader. It changes their relationships in the organization. You no longer have peers in the same way. You can't have the same kind of relationships, and you have to hold yourself differently. So that's something that's very important, I think, to make part of your explicit training of your priests, to help them also transition from layperson to priest. Now, the long trajectory that you have often does help with that. But I have seen instances where that's not necessarily clear, and it becomes cloudy for the lay people and for the priests. So it's an interesting thing.
The last exchange.
Yes, I'd be interested in what you think of something that we've done, which we were put in a position of becoming independent. And so we wanted to maintain something of a lineage tradition, but balancing it with some kind of congregational checks and balances. So in our bylaws, and it's mandated in the Articles of Incorporation, that the abbot has to be a transmitted Soto Zen priest. And but we can be removed by, there's a way to impeach us, the board can impeach us, but then it's a rather difficult process. There has to be a fairly strong mandate from a vote by the membership with a weighted ballot to remove us. Then there's a process by which there's a succession, I mean a replacement can be found, and it's the board that's in charge of that, but it has to be ratified by the membership, and it has to meet these criteria. So it really kind of puts them in a bit of a tight spot. They've got to be really sure what they're doing, and they have to come back into the transmitted Soto priest tradition. And then we have an elders council who holds their job is to hold the institutional memory of what our tradition is like.
Yeah.
They advise the board so that the person will be compatible with what our institution is. So how would you categorize that?
That's really interesting. You know, all of this really sounds to me like you're in that transition zone, where one thing is leaving, and the next thing is not yet born. So you're in that place of moving from one to another and doing the best you can. You know, that muddling through is the right place to be right now, as you see where it is and where it's going. It makes good sense.
Way of a more easy transition, which we're also working on.
Yeah. Transitions is a whole other big question, isn't it? And ways to do that.
So you see,
that's different.
So you see why I said that religious polity turns out to be very interesting. And what Hogan said is true. You can take any of the categories, any of those slides, and you could spend 3 hours with her unpacking what that means in actual instances. I'll just give you one example. The UU model is similar to our model because the congregation calls the priest. So let's say you have a little sitting group and they get big enough and they say, oh, we want a Zen teacher. And then they ask San Francisco Zen Center and they send somebody out who agrees, okay, I'll be the priest for that group. But they've found that that model doesn't work by itself. Or in the UU, you can call somebody from within your congregation even, can't you? Yeah. So just tell them what has happened where you've had to expand calling an individual congregation, calling a minister.
Well, that is very interesting. We our tradition grew out of calling people from within our own ranks and ordaining them. In fact, our congregations still are the ordaining body. We do not have an ecclesial body who ordains. However, to address some of these issues, we do have a ministerial fellowshipping committee that has ministers tested, kind of. You know, they meet before this group. They have to demonstrate competencies in, gosh, what is it, like 12, 17 different areas now, I think, including sexual health is a new one that was just added. So they have to demonstrate all of this stuff and convince this board that they see a minister there, and then they're adopted into fellowship. Well, a congregation can still call whoever they want, but these ministers who are in fellowship are ones that also have a blessing of a kind of larger body. So that's an interesting process, too.
No, we don't think
all the time. All the time.
Isn't that interesting? So you can, if you put that model on our situation.
Yeah, what would that mean?
Isn't that going to
give you headaches tonight?
This opens up a lot of ideas. So if we decided we wanted to ordain somebody, we would have to go to a council of you all and say, we're thinking of ordaining this person. Would you examine the person for us?
Or at
the level of transmission. Yeah, maybe at the level of transmission. And then they would get examined on 12 different areas, including sexual health, by this group.
So I just really commend you for beginning to look at these issues, because you've got it's a new world, you know, and you're adapting to it. So good luck. There's lots to learn.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Are you staying overnight?
Thank you.